Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Once again, adding some complication to your communication. How about that? More complicated, sophisticated communication.
It's like roughage in the diet, huh?
Something. We're trying to up your game a little bit. It's a lot of free talk on here from people who think a lot about language and what it does out in the world. So I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, stand-up comic, comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I like to get on here and talk to smart people about what's going on in the world and maybe what we can do to improve it. I don't know, deal with it, maybe improve it. Three things on the podcast, talk to comedians. I try to convert humans that have gotten off the pathway of righteous public discourse. And I talk to academics and persuasion professionals about rhetoric and public persuasion and private persuasion. What do you do with all these words to get people aligned to what you think the world should look like? Once again, we are back with Dr. David Payne, my main source, my reservoir. I go and fish.
Big rhetoric, for, dude. Whatever.
we'll go fish for big rhetoric fish. And we've been talking about the war lately. I wanted to sort of go even farther, more meta about it, and start talking do an episode on dystopias, rhetorical dystopia. About how badly everything can go and the stories of how badly it can go, which clearly war is sitting there in the dystopian realm. And so you've done a lot of work on failure and working in the sort of negative space of rhetoric. Just curious where we can get to if we start talking about dystopias, and we'll probably dovetail.
I didn't realize this when we hatched this topic, that I had written on dystopias of one sort or another.
And you're at that stage of your career where you don't realize the work you've done.
Well, it wasn't framed that way, but it was functionally, it indeed was that way. And I started reflecting that, you know, historically, in terms of rhetorical studies, certainly historically in terms of dystopias have a deep, longer tradition in apocalyptics. But, you know, the late 60s and early 70s were full of sort of these scientific dystopias as modes of persuasion, right? And they, people paid notice. Paul Ehrlich, Eco-Catastrophe, The Population Bomb, Alvin Toffler, Future Shock, Jeremy Rifkin, Entropy. I did wind up writing about a chapter on those and how they function rhetorically, and other people paid notice because it does, you know, I mean, the dystopian future serves as a kind of moral warning that this is the arc that we're headed toward, right? Fritz and Rushing really hopped on that with science fiction dystopias about technology. I mean, and you know, we were rife in those that somehow tech as a moral warning about technology, the Terminators, on and on and on. So science fiction dystopias were a big genre, as especially in their work, a whole spate of films about imagining dystopian futures as a warning about our technological development.
Yeah, technology and pollution, right? Like concrete dystopias. Like it's become kind of a moral, cultural dystopia now. Like one of the things I've seen the difference in the right and the left is the right talks about, they're trying to convince everybody we are in a moral, cultural dystopia. Like it's not, we're headed that way. It's like, oh, they're here and they've got control and we've got to do something to grab it back.
Well, yeah, I mean, it could be right now that we've got both kinds operating a lot. I mean, there is sort of the standard apocalyptics, and there is the sense that we're sort of there, right? That this is not, you know, some distant teleological outcome. This is kind of the cloud that we're entering in this phase. But we still, you know, the climate change stuff. And I started thinking about a lot of these sci-fi dystopias have sort of made a rebound. They remade Fahrenheit. Right, 514, whatever.
451,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael Moore fouled that up in my head, right? And The Handmaid's Tale was big, right? And everybody's going,
oh, yeah.
No, this is not like some... This is like on that, right? How things are going, right? So I think all that certainly.
Yeah, Handmaid's Tale is a really interesting example of that. That, you know, again, that's a very older, like themed, very familiar dystopia of, you know, kind of the past and sort of purging and like the crucible and all that kind of stuff just put into the present or the future.
Sure, and it's hard not to think about that with these states passing these anti-abortion laws. And, you know, you kind of think about Gilead and maybe I better be moving to Canada more in a more literal way than I think we were intended to. So anyway, I think that stuff is around and fermenting at the same time as this sort of cultural moral utopia. And I did think about the current war as an example that triggers this, because the way we're talking about it, we're not talking, you know, this is every moment is sort of the push to World War III, right?
The ultimate dystopia.
You know, well, we can't get Russia involved or we will be in World War III. You know, somehow we can't engage. I start thinking, well, you know, we've been in proxy wars since 1950 with Korea, Vietnam, on and on and on. Why weren't they, you know, the harbingers of World War III? Although I think in the Cold War, there was also this sort of cloud of possibility. But anyway, it seems more immediate and more like the frame in which we're interpreting the, you know, and that is the rhetoric of dystopia, right? Is that you right. Put that into that ultimate outcome frame.
Well, it's so, in the theater, right? It's now in the right location. It's in Europe and it's right. White people on white people. So it has all the, you know, echoes of World War II. Like it now has scenic, you know, symmetry to that past dystopia.
Well, I guess that's it, is that it echoes the Second World War in those kinds of ways that Iraq did not, even though, you know, both sides are supplying Afghanistan twice, once with the Russians and then with,
yeah,
you know, so it's not like we haven't been, you know, having our military equipment fighting Russian military equipment most of the time since 1950, our Chinese or whatever.
Right. But that's a non-dystopian view of war, right? That's a more therapeutic place to end up in, that we're fighting a proxy war here. It's not going to go beyond this level, you know, that we can handle these kind of things. Like you said, like it's our military weapons versus their military weapons. It's just the corporations once again expending their warehouses so they can, you know, charge
well,
us.
Well, that is kind of the comic view, but once again, I think that's getting tarnished with some of this imminent reality, you know.
Well, and like you said, like the images coming back from the Ukraine and things like that, which are dystopian images, the one about where they completely bombed out that port city, I can't even say the names,
right?
But they completely bombed it out. That was clearly a dystopian image. Like they showed it beautiful before and then just gray and just destroyed. And that's a strong dystopian World War II
image. Right. Zelensky's own little video did probably the best job of that, right? Of showing happy, dancing Ukrainians, then all of a sudden, but I remember making a similar film when I was a senior in high school about, oh, here's lovely nature, and then here's all of this pollution, right? We're sort of
right.
You're talking about dissonant strategies, right? And that's clearly there. Well,
and this is the challenge, I think. Like I watched this when I did a lot of work in the alternative health space with the vegans, using basically horror film techniques on big farming to show like cows being killed and things. And they were literally shot like horror films in the dark, crazy, you know, angles, stuff coming out of the, you know, shadows, sound shocks, all these different things. But when you see that, like with dystopia, and we're trying to see now where Ukraine needs to establish a strong dystopia that Americans can hold on to. But we immediately seem to start to become weary of dystopias. It only takes so much of it before it starts to lose, you know, its rhetorical potential.
Well, we become inured to the drama of it in some ways, but I wonder if the aggregate effect of it, I've often thought about, you know, the effect on a generation of children with teachers all sort of touting, if we don't toe the line, if we don't fix this, if we, you know, that we were doing this great job of informing and moralizing our children. But, you know, how long do you, you know, how long does it take before you kind of go, well, to hell with that. And what's important to me, to become, in a sense, inured to that kind of rhetorical approach.
Well, I think you nailed it with the ecological rhetoric of the 70s and 80s, which I grew up around, and you heard so much of it. I remember going to Mammoth Cave after I'd started doing stand-up, and it's the biggest cave in the country or the world, and it's in Kentucky. And so the park rangers were taking people around, but they were also doing dystopian ecological rhetoric the whole time. Like, they're blind fish down here and they're all dying because then he's like, do you know what they eat? And I'm like, I don't know, park rangers. So I started heckling him because I got so tired of being, you know, hit with that rhetoric. But it was clearly, you know, part of my growing up, that the ecological environmental rhetoric of dystopia. And now it's, like I said, I think it's shifted. The GOP has just shifted it over to culture and morality. It seems like, and even political dystopia.
Well, one way to sort of do denial on it is the you know, the sort of the politicization move. This is just more liberal, you know, and so there's direct sort of subversive attempts to get, you know, buy the biggest truck you can, and completely ignore it, deny climate change, which is an active interpretive industry, right? And at the same time, sure, what we're talking about on the other hand, right, how do people live with that kind of dissonance? At the same time, it is, once again, it isn't this sort of futurist warning. Every tornado is another example. I grew up in Kansas. We had tornadoes daily in the spring, right? But now each one is bigger, badder, not quite, you know, it's out of place. It's in some places it's supposed to be. And it's another harbinger of the climate change is real in here, right? And you have to look at how bad the winter's been and how hot the summers are. And you
know, right. So we got all this, we have all the symptomology of a dystopia, an actual dystopia, but maybe because we've heard so much of it for so long and it is still an abstraction. So it's easy for the people to get in and find political hay by denying it or blaming us about just trying to get more money for our research. You know, that like today, there's a thing today about rivers of current in the air are about to dislodge an ice shelf bigger than, you know, half of America that's been there since whatever.
Right.
And I looked at it, I'm like, okay, I've seen that a lot now, you know, the dislodging ice shelves, and I don't know what it means.
Well, we tend to manage to distance ourselves from things we can't control. What can you do about an ice shelf breaking off? It's not like, you know, I think of Mark Maron and in his End of the World comics figure. Well, we recycled. We took our bags to the store. We did as much as we could in the, you know, our attempts at, in the face of ice shelves breaking off and disappearing glaciers.
Right. So when you actually have to deal with a real dystopia that has symptomology all around you with like the weather and things, images you're seeing and, you know, all this stuff, people can't experience, like, we can't stay with it long enough for it to become politically efficacious to, you know, counter it. Like, and I think this is one of the problems with climate change, the whole rhetoric is that we've just pounded it so hard for so long that people don't have a reaction to it anymore.
Right. However, there may become this kind of interpretive or even rhetorical habit of mind, or it may even be a kind of a psychosis of sorts in a, you know, maybe a non-clinical sense, that, you know, what Berg labeled, you know, this tendency to take things to the end of the line, so that now we're encountering inflation. Oh my God, right? Inflation the worst inflation in 40 years or whatever, that interest rates have climbed at above zero, which was sort of the, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, these monumental shifts and people's behavior changing, right? In terms of last year was peak corporate profits. Yet 51% of Americans believe we are already in a recession, let alone the 80% that believe that we will be one by the end of the year. How are you already in a recession if the demand for these goods is at an all-time high? That means people have money to, anyway. These interpretive frames are floating around out there, all of which take it to the far wall, take it to the end of the line, which is the habit of reasoning of dystopia, right?
Well, and I think, you know, like, as rhetorical resources, I'm sitting here with my deck of cards, my two deck of cards. Here's my dissonance cards and my utopian cards, or my dystopian and my utopian cards. Right. I'm like, okay, how do I want to play these out? You know, as I go through political things, you're seeing the left right now play a lot of dystopian cards about if Trump gets reelected, if DeSantis, if, you know, all these things, like, they're going to destroy democracy. It's a dystopian destruction of democracy.
Right. Right. And we don't have, you know, really good history on how, you know, things, how sloppy things have been in the past. And I'm willing to say, and I don't know that things are worse now than they have been. And I think we have divisive times before. I think the early 60s obviously were hugely divisive. I think the Civil War, obviously, and other times. But we don't seem to be able to afford it now. I mean, I'm willing to go that far to say it doesn't seem like we can afford this because the consequences seem so dire. Well, and the whole point of utopian versus dystopian, it occurred to me to talk about, and I suppose maybe most people know this, but the idea of utopia, right, in Latin means nowhere. And so utopias were meant to be these idealistic outcomes, right, that were meant as a mirror to hold ourselves up to and thereby create dissonance and guide us. And then the dystopia was kind of a negative version of that, that is a moral warning to guide us away from that kind of thing. So what does it mean that a nowhere, a negative nowhere, turns into here? So, you know, this is not a feature of dystopia that doesn't exist in the world. It's the temptation is to believe you're already in it. And it seems to me that people are succumbing to that temptation.
Yeah, and we move people around psychologically through these constantly. I listen to the liberal rhetoric, and the Biden's rhetoric is very aspirational, very, you know, we can all be Americans and we can all get along. And, you know, those are all utopian outcomes. They're utopian situations. Right. Like, I used to, when people would say America's in a melting pot, I'd be like, yeah, it's more like a melting pit. You know, you just dump everything in there and who knows what's going to happen. It's not like it's a beautiful stew, you know. It's just right. As much of a, you know, landfill as it is a
there's still chunks floating around.
Yeah. And, you know, that sense of, is this like we're taking the exact same situations and the right is going, oh, that's a dystopia. We need to go back to the utopia of the past. And the left is like, oh, we're moving towards a utopia if we can just keep going and getting the conservatives and GOP people out of the way and let us clean this stuff up. So it is a retort. It is. Everybody's got to have both. They've got to have their utopian version, their dystopian version, and then their dystopian version of the utopian version. And those four just keep moving
back
and
forth.
Well,
right. There is the fall from an idealized mythic past, right? Yeah. And that is the conservative response, is to you must do reset somehow, which is the only way to really read, you know, a party right now that has absolutely no platform. That isn't to say there is no agenda. Obviously, there is.
Right. They have sheer technique.
Maybe, like, maybe it says if we actually told you what we plan to do, nobody would vote for us.
Right. But they've picked up the politics of dissonance, the politics of stain, the politics of dystopia, that if they can just attack and, you know, shit on everything that is in opposition to them, they get political traction. And they it's just over and over working that field over and over again to turn it darker and darker and darker.
Well, that does seem to be what's going on. Yet at the same time, on the other end of the spectrum, right, I think that is kind of the, at least one of the chief disenchantments of the progressive movement against Biden is, well, he's just not, you know, we need idealism. We need somebody to turn us on and, you know, the glint in the eye, the aspiration. And of course, you know, when at my age is kind of, I just want, you know, sane and normal, please. I'm tired of losing elections.
Right. So. Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, the progressive versus the centrist, you know, on the left is a really interesting rhetorical area for sure. Like, there's not enough of utopia here. Like, the whole, you're allowing all these dystopian elements to continue along like they're neutrals. But look at the profit center, look at the anti-union, and again,
yeah,
the progressives.
I don't have a speech to utopian and dystopian. Maybe you can figure it out. But here's Biden with a, I don't know, let's say 40, 42% approval rating, which is always reported as completely disastrous. Trump never got higher than that, and that was absolutely a victory. Furthermore, if you start asking the, you know, the 58% who disapprove, for what reason they disapprove, I'm pretty sure you're going to find some of those, a huge chunk of those are the progressive idealists. In other words, they don't really agree on what's wrong here or why it's dissatisfied. But yet we continue to pose this as a binary that spells nothing but disaster, and threatens that other party that gets 42% is absolutely going to win, and that's another dystopian motivator, right? One I'm deeply invested in, actually.
Right. Well, and I think if there is something that Trump does really well, it is dystopias. Like he just creates dystopia energy about everything. Like he literally, it's right now Trump versus truth, right? It's literally Trumpism and propaganda versus the concept of truth. Like I'm just going to say time and time again that the election was stolen and I don't care about truth. I'm going to make that a dystopia, whether you want to let me do that or not. And it's interesting to watch him just, you know, it's this kind of military onslaught, just keep shelling the people with these dystopian claims. Truth makes no difference whatsoever.
Well, and it could be kind of the oxymoron perhaps of having run on a previous dystopia. Oh, things are awful. We got crime in the streets. We got blah, 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 blah. And I'm going to make, you know, America better again. And then after 4 years, how can you say I'm going to make, you know, you can start saying, well, we're going to keep it better, but we didn't do anything. So we're still going to make it, or, you know, make it better again. So, you know, people are not living in the material reality that corresponds to these words. So I think maybe the stolen election is kind of the substitution. That is prima facie evidence of the dystopia that we are in an election. You can't, you know, it's been taken over by the bad guys. And this is a rescue operation.
Yeah. Evidence becomes an interesting concept within dystopias like this, right?
Or a missing one. I don't know.
But they have to create some type of evidence. Like the interesting thing I always thought about Hillary and the emails was that it was such a sinister kind of spyish, conspiratorial power behind the power phrase, you know,
right,
where the emails go, like you literally did a tech magic trick here to hide, and it doesn't matter what it is at that point. So it's a perfect stain because you can't disprove it. She's not going to release them at that point. Has all these hues of dystopia around it, literally technological dystopia and spy dystopia. And they've been looking for another one just as cleanly, you know, lance in the heart as that.
Well, and Hunter Biden is kind of that.
Yeah, a laptop.
There's more emails, and they say stuff. No, yeah, I sort of knew we were in trouble when a guy stopped me at the gym to talk with me, and that was his about the election, and that was his thing, is that there's a lot in these emails that's going to come out. There's a lot in these emails that's going to come out, which, as far as I can tell, there really wasn't hardly anything at all new there.
Right.
But the having created that vacuum for it, one can sort of imagine whatever else.
Hey, hold on just a second, Dave. I'm going to hit pause.
Sure.
All right, we're back. Sorry, quick brief interruption there for stuff going on behind me. Yeah. So
we were talking about evidence, right? And that.
Yeah.
What makes it evident to you? And somehow that evidence is cropping up, you know, gas prices.
Well, and evidence.
Tornadoes, right? Everything's a sign.
So fictive, sort of fictive dystopias, right?
Right.
They have the evidence of conspiracy level evidence. So it looks like it might be weird, or like I saw somebody post the other day that somebody walked up to them randomly at the airport, and they have a couple little kids, and they were telling the kids they're pedophiles. They kidnapped you. Just pay attention because I'm telling you right now. And so that whole pedophilia dystopia, you know, to make that fictive world real enough that people are holding on to it and using it as a template to look at the world, it's pretty impressive rhetoric.
Well, and talk about turning that into evidence. Yeah, the Supreme Court. I mean, that was quite a chain of associations to go from what was a, by all analyses, a very normal judicial record on making these sentences to evidence of, right? And that just fed right into. So once again, the utopia provides the mythic context in which these things become signs, and therefore the evidence that right of the moral dangers. So they, right, it is a psychosis. These things mean things well beyond, right, in a context of some sort of woven interpretive reality where things all have their supercharged meanings. Anyway, the pedophilia thing is fascinating and scary.
It is, but it's that sense of the supernatural within your dystopia, right? And I think that's a strong element in all this stuff that we're so used to superhero stories and supernaturalism and religion and mysticism, that putting it into a real life story isn't that weird for people anymore. They're like, yeah, maybe they're blood drinking pedophiles. I don't know.
Well, you know, how can you say that they're not?
Prove it to me. Yeah. Prove to me that dystopia is not real.
It's possible. What do I know? Right.
When I see that stuff start to echo out into people's operant belief systems, you know, their day-to-day interaction with other human beings systems, and you're like, wow, I think that's where so many people get just amazed by fictive rhetoric, this kind of narrative rhetoric of dystopian collusive stories and things like that. It's sticking. Like, it's actually sticking in people's minds, and they're now operating with it out in the world.
Right.
And I'm like, well,
right,
that's what rhetoric is supposed to do. It's supposed to maybe start as language, move into your head, and then become behavior. Like, that is the, you know, that is the flow.
Right. Well, you know, I think we have to get at, you know, what is a belief system, and the sort of the rational traditional concept is that people try to maintain some sort of, you know, integrity and coherence in among their beliefs. But I'm not sure psychologically that's necessarily the case. And since we have these different sorts of plausibility universes and media inputs, or fictional universes, if you want to call them that, you know, it's troubling to me that the idea of the metaverse, right? This idea,
right.
That we're going to feed our children on a new metaverse where everybody's, you know, in alligator avatars or whatever's going on there. I don't know. Let's add one more, you know, that these things do bleed into each other. And I think that's where the concept of psychoses is relevant. And that we can have, you know, disassociations that most people probably do maintain a number of plausibility structures.
Gonna make it? You all right?
I need water.
Need some water? Yeah, go ahead. I'll hit pause. All right, we're getting bumped.
So I think one thing that the internet does, and our way of participating, say chat rooms or other kinds of contact systems, so like QAnon or whatever that is, some sort of web behavior, web sociology does allow one to, you know, and I would think if you were to really find most of these people, the number of people who absolutely believe it fervently, and are willing to make that their mainframe operating reality are probably very few. Most people, I think, probably engage it as a kind of a plausibility form of entertainment where nothing is really at stake. Yet nonetheless, that becomes a framework that they can then refer back to, make associations back to out of other, like, political reality. So that, you know, the pedophilia, this is just, once again, more evidence of our profound associative abilities. How abstract the basic human can function. The child porn, and certainly they had some agents there like Ted Cruz making this seem like a very real thing. And that once again sort of feeds back into that plausibility structure of some sort or another. So people are probably walking around with a number of indeterminate, plausible, or potential, or even mythic or cartoon-like systems, but they don't believe them with equal intensity. And except, usually it's not until those are by some sort of agent put into dissonance with each other that one has to choose, right?
Right. Well, they're never.
And that's what political rhetoric does.
In a way, I guess that's true, but they never really do have to choose. It seems like everybody's self-selecting now, and just if they're running into somebody that wants to puncture their dystopia, they just avoid them. There was a nice little interview this week of there's a whole crew now of freelancers and Comedy Central who send people to the Trump rallies to do interviews and just, present a little bit of logic or something and catch these people into saying the craziest shit that they've got. And one of the things this week was like, so if Trump is still in charge and he's been running the whole thing the whole time, the one this week was Antifa. They're like, yeah, Antifa was responsible for January 6th. Like, well, why would they interrupt their own win? Like, they won that election. And the guy just froze. And they just they just stayed on it for like 30 seconds. And he literally could not talk anymore.
Interesting. It's like, there's about 10 old Star Trek episodes where Kirk outsmarts a computer by using logical contradiction.
Yeah.
And the computer just spritzes and
right. It just starts to smoke. Yeah. But people, when you hold them to their feet to the logical fire, sure. But they don't do that themselves. They just skim right past it and stay in the narrative. Sure. Right.
And maybe the point or a point is that politics simply becomes another one of these. I mean, politics has always attracted extreme fringe types, right? The people who live in James called it a double storied mystery, right? They have unintegrated lives, the true believers, right? And so, that is kind of the, so voting and the voting season for most people is highly specialized and mostly, an unpenetrating set of choices that they make close to the election. Most people are not watching either MSNBC or I guess a lot of people are watching Fox, but that's still not, right? That still is a kind of an entertainment frame that's reinforcing these extraordinary, but they don't act on them. They're not conducting life on these. So I guess the politician has to somehow activate that and make it seem real only for the purpose of choosing, at the time of the vote.
Right.
Which seems to be all of the season. But most people by and large are not want really, and that becomes more and more evident. So I've become always suspicious of 70% of Republicans think, but there's only 27% of the people who say they're Republicans, right?
Right.
So what does that statistic mean?
So that's like exactly. 12% of the population says.
I know.
Yeah.
And there's always been like 20% of the population who will believe almost anything. There's nothing new about that. Once again, the dramatism of media tends to exacerbate those extremes. And those are kind of more like video game worlds than they are, right? Reality information systems.
Well, and then we go back to the war, right? Which is clearly a lived dystopia for people in Ukraine right now. And people are dying and things are being destroyed. But we're experiencing it still as a fictive dystopia.
Right, right.
Yeah, it is not real to us.
Well, you know, everybody got so mad at Jean Baudrillard when he said that Vietnam was not a real war. And they were just so upset with him about this, right? Real people died. Well, that isn't really what he was saying. He was talking about how do you experience this and how does it mean for you?
Right.
But I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think once again, it is this kind of, I'm having to live in a world where this can happen.
Well, and the difference between a cartoonish, as you were saying, dystopia and a documentarian dystopia, which is what they're trying to do with Ukraine, is to document it enough to the point where it has a reality through the media for people that will never go there and probably never meet a Ukrainian. And that documentarian feel that they have for the footage. And you're like Sean Penn coming out and saying, you know, I had to walk on foot to get out of the Ukraine because I was shooting my documentary there. And now I'm thinking about arming and going back and fighting Russia myself. Well, that's just a really fascinating juncture of Hollywood. They've never known what to do with Sean Penn because he actually goes to the dystopian location.
Right.
You know, like when the Republicans, when the GOP, the senators went down to the border, which they want to make a dystopian location. And they did this fictive visit of putting on a, you know, vest and standing there at night with a light. Everybody's like, no, that's bad, fictive dystopia. We're not buying it. But now you're getting over here to Ukraine, which is a real thing. And like, it's not being documented in the way people want somehow. You know, it's not being made real enough or coherent enough in a narrative that people can hold on to. We're getting fragments of dystopia.
What's that?
We're getting fragments of dystopia.
Right, but we are kind of putting it together into, you know, one bundle. I think that this is, you know, Holocaust, it's genocide. All of the terms are coming out.
Right? Well, the chemical weapons last week, they're trying to yank it over into our formed up dystopian narratives for war.
Right.
Like which one will hit the bell strongly enough for Americans to go, you know what? Maybe we'll take a shot at this World War III thing.
I think more and more you're getting people that are willing to say, yeah, why are we stopping at this line? I don't know whether they've even tried to do polling. So there does seem to be this kind of sober reality to it. And in terms of simply persuasion and legitimacy, each time we kind of jump to that edge, then you know, the drip, drip, drip of news is, well, and Biden approved another $800 million, and that seems okay, right? This gets us through the news cycle.
At least we're firing money at Putin. We're firing, you know, we're doing economic warfare.
Pretty much. I keep thinking about it. And yet, talking about dissonant worlds, yet here we are with inflation and in a recession. Not. And each Javelin missile cost $80,000. Every one that we fire could take an American family and put them in the upper 2% of income.
It's crazy. Yeah.
But we don't dare spend any of that kind of money.
Well, have you seen the meme about war is, you know, guys who don't make $2 a week shooting weapons that they will never earn as much the entire life at a airplane that or a tank that costs more than their entire village will ever make. And yeah, that's
tanks
what
are worth about $4 million, something like that.
Yes,
yeah. It's truly an amazing thing and I guess that's the goal of the rhetoric, just turn the calculator off compared to really being in the war. But
well, that's what we did with Vietnam, right? They turned the calculator back on. It's like, hey, this is just a corporate exercise, look at this. You know, and then the Halliburton in Desert Storm, like that's one of our evils, one of our villains that we'll allow back into the dystopian narrative. Hey, this is all just corporations spending, you know, their wares so they can repopulate the
no,
profits.
No. This is the government giving money to corporations.
Well, yeah, but then they do the turn of, well, the government is just a shill of the corporations anyway. So, But, you know, that dystopian behind the scenesness of like, who are the villains? Can we make them clear? Is there enough clarity that we can establish them as villains in this world so that people will then act in these ways? And you see it, it's again, it's just this big conglomeration of these two sides trying to force villains up into the spotlight. Like Putin isn't, everybody knows the word Putin, but how often is he actually, I mean, how much interaction have we had with that guy the last 25 years? I don't know much about him.
It's true. It's true. And I heard a little snippet that he had enjoyed like a 40% popularity, right? Higher than most of our own domestic politicians until this debacle, right?
Yeah. And the KGB, you know, they pull those three letters out and they throw those on him. And you're like, well, he must be bad. Like the KGB thing, he came from, you know, spy world.
Right. Which means he's capable of all these dark genius-like moves. But as it, I guess, turns out, he wasn't really that big of a deal in the KGB. He was kind of more a bureaucrat or whatever. I certainly don't know. I think both narratives are out there.
Well, take it out of the war and like go to dystopian, like the dystopian stories of self. Like I see these a lot and you probably, you know, speak to this, but I see a lot of it having come from Austin and now being in LA, the dystopia, the internal dystopia that you are. I watched the movie Her last night with Joaquin.
Right. I have not seen that one, but yeah.
It's kind of slow, but it was written by a guy, you know, who did Being John Malkovich and very internal and neurotic. And so you're basically exposed to this guy's neurosis for 2 hours. And he ends up with, you know, I'm a horrible person and but then he gets an epiphany, which is kind of weak. But it's this, the dystopia of the self. I'm so neurotic. I'm bad for everybody who comes into contact with me and ergo why I can't have a good relationship. But I see a lot of that in Austin, like everybody working on their internal dystopia.
Well, I guess that's one way you can think about it. I think our psychologistic therapeutic rhetoric does basically the same design on how one thinks about themselves, their origins and their trajectory. And the basic rhetoric of conversion, right? Of you're living this
it's life dystopia of sin. To utopia, right? It's,
and if you died tonight, what would happen to you? Well, going to the big utopia, right? So it does moral discourse in the same kind of ultimate terms that you evaluate each little thing. So yeah, I mean, listening to rock and roll music or smoking cigarettes or drinking or whatever happens to be your sin, each individual act doesn't seem so bad, but it all adds up to right
internal dystopia. You are going, and then you're going to the ultimate dystopia, which is hell, right?
That's how you think this is bad.
Yeah. Guess what? There's a really bad dystopia that.
So all of those become warrants for transformation, right? Those all become warrants. So these are the things that tell you what to change, that guide you to this synergistic, more positive outcome. So yeah, the rhetoric of conversion and therapy has been full of that kind of existential, malaise. and who doesn't feel that, right? So
This is why I've always really liked rhetoric, because rhetoric to me just lifts it back up always into the technology, the linguistic technology. Like, sure. I don't care. Like, yeah, I can feel lonely or, you know, depressed or malaise, you know, all the disenfranchisement, all that kind of stuff. But they're really just the outcomes of me believing I'm in a dystopia, right? That there was a good tweet the other day. Somebody's like, why is life so expensive? And I'm not even having any fun. You know, it's like, yeah, why is it a dystopia? Why am I in this dystopia? And then, it's probably my fault. Like, I'm in there because of my bad internal dystopia.
Sure. It's back to the control thing. That's the only thing you can control. So ultimately it has one way or another, no matter where the fault begins in the world, it winds up in your lap, because all you can control is you and your actions, right?
Well, I know this from working with businesses, that you've got to get people into pain, into dissonance, into dystopian feelings before you can get them to do anything, really. So I have to go in and disparage their current communications Like, oh, you're losing customers because people run into this brand. They're like, what is this? It's terrible. And you never even get to sell to them. And if I can get them into that state and like, oh yeah, I can come in and fix that for you because I understand utopia and how to build a utopia.
Right. Or, you know, I mean, all ideological persuasion operates in the same fashion, right? It's that, how do you explain someone's misery and pain to them, right? Ultimately you can say, well, it's because of this out there. It's because of, you know, liberals. It's because of immorality. It's because of whatever. In that sense, the current conservative, ideology doesn't operate any different than the Marxist ideology. It explains to you in grand terms in ways that give you a choice and empower you to do something about it in an individual, right? It is yourself that's going to get on board of this, and whether or not the real outcomes occur in the world, you purify yourself, right?
Yeah, the rhetorical strategies are the same. They're just changing out content.
Right.
I've got to get people to feel a certain type of dissonance because I have to attach that to a dystopia that has causes. Like, here are the causes of that dystopia, and then I have to promise I can change that.
Well, once again, we talked about how living in this psychotic, overly interpreted, collaborated or confabulated world, gas prices become a looming sign of the end, or tornadoes become a sign of the climate change debacle. Whatever, or snowed again, oh my God, that it's true. The same thing is, then your feelings become evidence, right? Your misery, your anxiety, your whatever is bothering you, right? That's why Tom Wolfe in The Me Decade opens up with the scene of the woman in the EST meeting, where he's told her to focus on that one thing that's bothering you, and she stands up and screams, "My hemorrhoids!" That's the one thing that's keeping her business world, her confidence at meetings, from being perfect, right? it's a brilliant essay, right? And this is 1974.
Sure.
So at any rate, it is that thing that is somehow, that flaw in the world that is somehow internalized into your interior way of going through the world. And it is that, you know, speaking the language within of this rhetoric. So, right, it is the inside and the outside. They're working together.
Well, and it's such an odd space to try to stay with your good rhetorical critic theorist distance, where like you're feeling these things that are being forced in, even because you're a human being, even though you know it's being constructed rhetorically. And you're like, okay, how do I see this for other people that don't even have the rhetorical apparatus to separate from those feelings a little bit and see what's going on? Like, when I talk to people and they're just so, you know, stuck in the dissonance of what's been dumped into them from both sides, you know, my daughter getting really, really upset about trans rights and why it's so unfair. And I just watch her just clench up and just all the emotions there. And I'm like, hey, let's step back and look at it from a meta perspective, so you don't get completely locked up into this emotional, you know, broccoli head that you're just crunched and you can't do anything in it. And I think that's one of the things I use rhetoric as, is like, hey, it's not about right or wrong or what, it's about getting some rhetorical distance, some meta space, so that you can be functional. Because otherwise, okay, you're just being pushed around by all these, this ocean of dissonance.
I think that's right. Finding a way at least to bracket some of that stuff off and to, ideally maybe focus your own efforts, right? You only got so many disaster cards to spend here. Which one is going to be the thing that you work against, right?
Well, and everybody getting upset because of the slap, you know, Will Smith's slap of Chris Rock taking media precedence over Ukraine.
Right.
I'm like, do you realize, like, I'm going to do a show at some point on that slap. There's so much that happened in that moment. We'll have to come back around to it next time, maybe, because it was so perfectly real in a completely fictive environment. And it just brought all these things together in this single moment. And plus, I'm good friends with Chris Rock's main writer. So I can actually get some insight.
Well, he said he was working on it, that when he talks about it, it will be funny. So maybe you have an insight into how he will eventually turn this to something else.
Yeah, we'll see. But I mean, the dissonance of, you know, the dystopia of that, like, and it was funny for comedians, the immediate dystopia for comedians was, hey, you know how bad it is in clubs right now, because you can't say anything without some Trumper or somebody just jump up and yelling at you and heckling. Right. Now you've empowered them to also physically attack you.
Well, that was Colbert's first line. Is let me start by saying it's never right to hit a comedian.
You know, I've seen it happen multiple times over the years where an audience member will attack a comedian, you know, in a club. I've seen Marc Maron actually get tackled on stage one night. Yeah, he was having a horrible set at the Largo here in LA, and he wasn't on and he didn't care. And the audience didn't like him. He got to the end. He was so like, because I'm going to do my bit about suicide and then I'm going to get out of here. And the guy in the front row was like, no, you're not. And Maron's like, how dare you censor me? Like, I'm going to do it. And the guy's like, no, my brother killed himself 2 months ago. I don't want to hear this. And Maron's like, well, sorry, I'm going to do it. And the guy just tackled him on stage.
Yeah.
End of the show. Like, and I was walking out afterwards.
However, it was kind of the only way to rescue that night for him.
And I told him, I was walking by and he was talking to Janine Garofalo. And I'm like, hey, Maron, best closer in the business, man. Said, you killed it. And he was pretty whacked out at that point. But it's the sense of when comedy can be like when you can physically respond, that's dystopia for comedians.
Well, you know, I mean, and people kind of became suspicious that this was staged, because it's the only thing one cared about or remembered about the Oscars this year, right? So.
Yeah, it could have been staged, but no, there's not even, it wasn't even close to being staged. Like, I have people still ask me like 2 weeks later, like, was that staged? I'm like, no, that wasn't staged.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way Chris Rock just sort of let it happen is, you know, one wonders.
The last thing you expect is reality in the middle of your fiction.
Fiction. Right. Well, I you know, Victor Turner, the sociologist, and talked about, in the social drama, that there is this rupture, right? And that was the rupture. That was the breach. And that's in the... that all of a sudden, then we've got to start. And that is another kind of dystopian social psychology there. Oh, something terrible happened that is, you know, out of the normal, and it must be explained. It must be repaired somehow. You've got to rearrange everything to put it into place. And that's similar to how we're reading all of these other events, you know, the war and, you know, the climate catastrophes and on and on and on.
Well, and we'll talk about this in a future episode, what I've been calling the multiplicity. Like, it's not a synchronicity. It's a multiplicity. Right. And the metaverse is a version of it, because you run out of story resources in superhero world if you're only in one world. If you can suddenly break the universe and add in other universes with other rules, then I think we're going to have a hard time story-wise holding on to that for very long. It just gets too much. Right. But right now, we're basically, it's dystopias fighting other dystopias for the attention of the population. It's a war between dystopias.
Sure. There's only so much mind space for her.
I can only take so much dystopia. Which one you got for me?
Well, you know, oddly enough, I thought about all of this watching the new Spider-Man the other night, which sort of features the multiverse. And the ability to extend the story by bringing back the previous Spider-Men and the villains into one. And of course, you know, the spate of superhero narratives is they're all dystopian, right? They're all ultimate. I mean, the nice thing about the comics when I was a kid is, you know, Superman caught some bank robbers or something, right? I mean, occasionally he'd do something earth-shaking, but it was kind of out there.
It's
wasn't
enough. Stakes aren't
enough. We didn't destroy New York for 25 minutes at the end of air, you know. We didn't reenact 9-1-1 in grand terms every time. So that whole language has sort of been assimilated, that there's, and I was sort of toying with my fellow watchers saying, well, if you can bring back all these other Spider-Men because they were in other movies, why can't you bring John Wayne into this movie? Why can't you? Yeah, they were in a movie once. Why can't Clark Gable show up? Why are there any new rules here? Right.
There's not.
Why are we only bringing back these guys?
Well, and I think our training, you know, we look at our narrative and our fictive training that we get from the media and from our books and things about our Bibles, about dystopias. And clearly dystopian rhetoric is a really strong architecture within rhetoric. And you watch it play out in the election coming up. Essentially, I think, you know, Biden, he said this fairly recently, we're like, do you want to run against Trump again? He's like, yes, please. Because for the left, Trump is walking dystopia. It doesn't go, it never goes away. It always gets worse. He is the sign.
Yeah, he is the sign. And that's unfortunate, because I think there probably are more dangerous people around. It's as frightening as it is to say that. And I worry about them. But I've heard political commentators recently say the same thing, that the only thing that will rescue the Dems is to put Trump on the ballot. That is, you're voting to keep Trump and Trumpism at bay here. That's the only thing that elected Biden and unified people. So you're right. There are these there's a multiverse here and a multiplicity. And we're more and more, you know, like countries that have to forge coalitions. I mean, you know, there's 40 political parties. And you've got to get three of them big enough, even though you may not agree on stuff. And we don't function. Mythically, we don't function that way, but we're having to forge that somehow.
I think we're all
kind of at that stage, right?
Right. I mean, a balkanized state almost sounds better than a coherent red, you know, half of the country.
Right.
Like, keep them in, like, this is what everybody always was about, like, Iran and Iraq. It's like, as long as they're fighting each other, they don't turn against us. So that was the whole policy in the Middle East, it seemed like, as well. Keep them where they don't have nuclear weapons, just let them fight forever, and they will never band together to come at the West.
Right. Well, and this is kind of the weak spot in, you know, the Biden coalition, as it was referred to mostly by the Republicans, the Lincoln Project guys. I've heard, you know, the African Americans, he hasn't delivered the things that they wanted, so they're not enchanted. The progressives didn't get the things they wanted, and so they're not enchanted. The only thing that will get their attention to say, well, if you keep thinking that way, you're going to reelect Trump.
Right, you'll get your dystopia. You'll get a much worse dystopia. Like, I think the politics of, hey, Biden's not a dystopia. They keep trying to dystopia him, the progressives do. But they're basically saying, you haven't delivered on a utopian vision. And I don't think he ever gave a particularly new utopian vision other than just straight democracy. Like, he was just utopian democracy about, we don't do this, we don't this, we just need to vote.
Yeah, let's resurrect the old civil, the vision of civil society and politics that work. And, and there is going to come a point, and maybe we're there, that just seems naive and, quaint. Generationally we move on.
It's a bland narrative, though, to go back to just the civil democracy. I don't think is enough of utopia for a lot of.
But Biden can still be emblematic of the dystopia from the other side, the Trumpian dystopia, the MAGA or, you know, the hard right dystopia. He's another sign of all this liberalism, all this wokeism. I mean, my God, nominating that black woman. To the Supreme Court.
They can dystopia anybody. You know, all you need is, like, look at his facial, his body language. He completely believes the Green New Deal. You know, again, that's why I said, like, evidence becomes useless really in that world, because it just needs an iota or even just a hint or a waft of what it is to just, then they just fan it and blow it up. So evidence really doesn't work in the same way for that type of rhetoric.
And once again, that is classic religious kind of reasoning, right? Reminded of the story of a Skid Row preacher, right, who was preaching preaching hellfire and damnation, and some old drunk says, "Oh, this is really boring." And the minister says, "See there, the devil is here among us, right?"
hecklers are the devil.
Anything that distracts can automatically be folded into the narrative, right?
Yeah, well, and that's the power.
And I think once again, if you lived in that supercharged psychotic universe, that becomes the way it is. Anything becomes a sign.
Yeah, that's
this monarchy in a split world.
Again, this is why I find dystopias really fascinating. I think utopias, maybe we'll talk about that at some point in the future too. Like, how do you construct a really compelling utopia? Because clearly that's what the left runs more on, utopias, this utopian vision of democracy and everybody getting along and things like
progress,
that.
Right? It's something to move toward, right? Although once again, the idealized past has its similarities, I suppose, but...
In a way, but they don't really talk about the past. They hit it a little bit, but they don't.
And I think that's right, is that amid this sort, you know, and I think this is a great segue to our wrapping up moment of thinking about the rhetoric of the next election in, you know, just sort of these competing dystopian realities, that where is this positive forward-looking vision that people can buy into? It's pretty thin.
Is it even strong enough to get people to vote? Is it psychologically activating? Most of our,
I think, rhetorically kind of has to be there, you know.
I would hope,
but I don't know, like, that people actually depend on it.
But it's more the psychological activation is more escaping the dystopia, right? That's the real victory.
I think so. We'll see whether anybody can forge a meaningful and compelling. But I think that is kind of the question. But, you know, once again, progressivism depends on that kind of, but that vision is itself the nightmare of the right. And
we'll circle back around. We'll do rhetoric of utopia here soon, because I think, you know, if you look at progressivism, what they need to actually create rhetorically in the world, a vibrant utopia that isn't just, hey, you know, I'm going to give you free childcare, you know, and things like that. It needs to have that type of texture and heft if it's going to function, because it's functioning against, like what you're saying, a multiplicity of really heightened, highly charged dystopias. Like, the sophistication of the dystopian rhetoric is really high right now. They're doing it really well. And if utopia is going to compete, it's got to have the same, you know, texture and depth. Seems to me. Well, you get out there.
I would love to be able to disagree.
You get out there and do your, David's been building a retaining wall against the right, right? It's just a big political retaining wall.
Well, I was actually against erosion, but it's, you know, we can see it as a metaphor.
I think we can completely.
Or we can say, why bother, right? Florida is going to be underwater soon. Why bother?
That's true. Well, you built your intellectual retaining wall for years in universities, right? For the students.
There you go. There you go. The ivory tower. above the fray. Yeah. Even though the river may be up.
Well, thanks for popping on again. Always fun. We will circle
Very
back
good.
Around and we'll talk to Dave Payne again. Get out there, persuade some people, break dystopias, build dystopias, do whatever you need in order to get things oriented to us all living in a decent place. And we will circle back around.
Find your own personal utopia.
Yeah, your own personal utopia. My own private Idaho utopia. All right, we'll see you.